sitting in town for like 10 days and they made the call to send us home. They are the understanding that there's really nothing to catch out there right now.
The pollock fleet is having trouble finding fish in the Bering Sea. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, August 31st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the village of Dot Lake loses an essential community building.
There was no apparent cause. There's nothing that should have been combustible in the area that the fire started.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
Unalaska Dutch Harbor is the busiest fishing port in the world, and the fish that fuels that distinction is pollock. But this pollock season has been a bust so far, and many boat owners have started sending crews home. KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez has the story.
In a normal year, a fisherman leaving Unalaska just 3 months into pollock bee season would probably be a happy guy who wrapped up fishing early. But this hasn't been a normal year. For most of August, catcher vessels have been idling at the docks. Some of the boats that have gone out are taking much longer trips than usual and only coming back half full of pollock. Now, things look bad enough that some boats are even taking a break from fishing and sending their crews home. Scott Bingen fishes on the Starlight, and he flew out of the Unalaska airport on Tuesday afternoon.
We've been sitting in town for like 10 days, and they made the call to send us home. You know, could be 3 weeks, could be... We might not be back till next year. So I think they are the understanding that there's really nothing to catch out there right now.
The Starlight, along with three other boats under the same management, plan to give fishing a go again in October. But with the cost of fuel, the wear and tear on the boats, and the low prices for pollock, fishing just hasn't been profitable. That's been a big surprise since pollock fishing was supposed to improve this year. The total allowable catch for this year was set at 1.2 million metric tons, over 50% more than what it was in 2010. Unless conditions change dramatically, it looks like the rebound might not be as large as models predicted. So far, only 60% of the season allocation has been harvested by all sectors, with only 2 months of fishing left to go. Bingen says that's not for lack of trying.
You might have been able to use that argument maybe 15, 20 years ago if this had happened, but I mean, the efficiency of this fleet out is really, it's amazing, and, you know, some would argue perhaps too efficient. I mean, you know, people know where to go, they've got the gear, the horsepower to catch it. I mean, I think that's a big problem with underestimating the capacity and the experience of this fleet. Is if there's fish out there, they're going to find it.
Members of the pollock fleet aren't just worried about their bottom line this year. They're also worried about what's going on with the pollock stock, and some have questioned the raising of the pollock quota. When Senator Lisa Murkowski visited Unalaska last week, she spoke to about a dozen fishermen about this issue. She says that she was struck by their calls for more conservative management of the pollock fishery.
These are fishermen who, by all rights, should be saying, I'm in it for the highest value dollar for me. But that was not their perspective. Their perspective was, we need to make sure that we are wisely managing these fisheries. We're concerned that this decision is not a wise decision for the future of a sustainable fisheries. That's the type of leadership that we want to see within our fisheries. Them questioning some of the decisions right now, I do think is clearly appropriate. They're looking for the long term. We all should be.
Last year, they had it projected at 1.6 million metric tons. In Unalaska, I'm Alexander Gutierrez.
One of the highest-profile murder cases in Bethel history is heading to trial soon. Last October, 19-year-old Benjamin Kaiser of Hooper Bay was murdered in a Bethel shop in what seasoned officers called the most brutal killing they have ever investigated. The trial has been moved hundreds of miles to Fairbanks. The court has promised that people in Bethel can attend telephonically, but at the last hearing, not even the prosecuting attorney in Bethel was able to participate. KYUK's Shane Iverson reports.
Facing murder charges are Jeff Hout of Bethel and Harry Williams of Queetluck. Another man, David Kenny of Bethel, was charged with interfering with an investigation. All three were scheduled for a procedural hearing on August 17th. What happened there is unknown, except to those that were in Fairbanks where the hearing was based. See, the 4th Judicial District moved the case from Bethel to Fairbanks because of the charges involving Kenny. He was a law clerk at the Bethel courthouse when he was arrested. District Presiding Judge Doug Blankenship was in Bethel this spring and said because Kenny was a worker at the Bethel courthouse, the case would be moved.
Judges' duties are to be fair and impartial, and there's also a requirement that there not be an appearance of impropriety. And it may raise questions publicly if there's a judge sitting on a case where there was a court employee involved.
That was Blankenship speaking to KYUK in April when the case was moved to Fairbanks. He said then that there was a lot of public interest in the case. So he said the Bethel public could listen in telephonically from a courtroom in Bethel.
So that if there's anyone interested in listening, they can check the Bethel court calendar, find out when the hearing is and come into court and sit and listen to that audio.
The judge actually hearing the case is Michael McDonald in Fairbanks. A district attorney from Bethel has been assigned to prosecute the case for the state of Alaska.
Judge McDonald will be sitting in court in Fairbanks. And they will get the attorneys on the phone.
Except that is not what happened at the last hearing. The district attorney, June Stein, along with a couple people from the Bethel public, were left waiting in the hallway outside a locked courtroom door at the Bethel courthouse. After three reminders, clerk staff unlocked the door and allowed us in. It was quiet in the courtroom, giving the appearance that the hearing was behind schedule. That was until a voice came over the courtroom speaker system. It was Judge McDonald saying that the hearing was over. Looking shocked and confused, District Attorney Stein told Judge McDonald that she had just now been included in the hearing. Quote, "We've been here waiting 20 minutes. We didn't want the court to think we weren't here," she said. Judge McDonald said, quote, "Oh my goodness, the court apologizes." But McDonald had already excused the defendants and their attorneys. He added that the problem was due to confusion in the Bethel Fairbanks court case. Trying to salvage what she could of the hearing, Stein said that the state was not ready for the upcoming murder trial and that she had been planning to request it be rescheduled for another date. Too late, said McDonald, who had already confirmed that the trial will go forward next month. Stein asked what else happened in the hearing. Judge McDonald said that he had granted the accused, David Kenny, a change of attorney. Kenny would drop his lawyer and the court would appoint a public defender. Before the hearing, Stein said she was planning to protest that change, but she never got the chance. Quote, "This is unacceptable, Judge McDonald," Stein added. She was asked for a recording of the hearing to review what she had missed. KYUK has asked for that same recording. The clerk's office in Bethel says they have requested a copy of the audio and notes from Fairbanks where it was recorded. That was over 2 weeks ago, and the Bethel office says those materials have not yet arrived. A call to Judge Michael McDonald was not returned. The Bethel clerk's office says they will record the trial from their office in the future. The trial is currently set to take place the last week of September. I'm Shane Iverson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, it's been a good year to fish pink salmon in Southeast.
Probably blown away any previous value record, and it's still going.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
A fire burned down a utility building in Dot Lake Sunday, taking out essential infrastructure in the Alaska Highway community between Delta Junction and Tok. Village Council President William Miller says no one was hurt in the late-night fire, but that it destroyed the over 3,000 square foot facility, valued at more than $500,000. Miller says the building housed necessities for the community of 45 people.
That building was our washateria, laundromat. We had showers and restrooms in there. And it was also a the heat plant, which contained 400,000 or 500,000 BTU boilers. And it provided piped underground heat to about six of the homes in the village.
Miller says it also provided water to the homes and other Dot Lake area residents who hauled water from the facility. The fire also knocked out power to the village community hall. He says local responders were unable to help fight the fire because a portable water pump failed. An investigator was on scene yesterday, and Miller says the cause of the fire does not appear to be accidental.
There was no apparent cause. There's nothing that should have been combustible in the area that the fire started. But you can't lay the blame one place or another because this is a facility that everybody used. Everybody depended on it. So it's hard to try and point a finger one way or the other.
Miller says nothing from the facility is salvageable except the well. He says the village is seeking a state disaster declaration and is already getting help from the Tanana Chiefs Conference and the Alaska Intertribal Health Consortium to bring the well back online.
Try to get a small structure built over the wellhead and re-energize the well, get a temporary boiler, a holding tank, and then be able to circulate the hot water heat through the system to at least keep the lines from freezing up and to get the domestic cold water back to the homes.
Miller says the goal is to try to get the water system operating again before freeze-up. He says the community is getting by in the meantime by making use of other facilities, including homes outside the village core area and the Dot Lake Tribal Offices and School, which have their own water systems. Yesterday, with Alaska's U.S. Senators Lisa Murkowski and Mark Begich, and several senior federal agency officials, Secretary of Health and Human Services Kathleen Sebelius took part in a roundtable discussion hosted by South Central Foundation, an Alaska Native healthcare organization serving Anchorage, the Mat-Su Valley, and several rural villages. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
South Central Foundation President and CEO Catherine Gottlieb says she appreciates Senators Murkowski and Begich's advocacy on behalf of tribal health programs and that President Obama is listening to tribes. For instance, she says his administration has worked to cover indirect costs, which helps support about 100 SCF jobs.
Our president is listening. He's coming. He's meeting with the tribes. He's increased contract support costs. We have benefited from that contract support cost increase and have produced many, many jobs. And then in the same breath, of course, when we didn't get contract support costs and it fell short, it was $5.5 million that impacted South Central Foundation directly.
Sobelia says she's visiting Alaska because it's important to see things firsthand, and what she's seeing reinforces what she's heard about Alaska's high costs, transportation issues, and gaps in even the deployment of broadband used in telemedicine and the effects of not funding indirect costs.
Contract services not being funded are life and death decisions. If people can't have their health care delivered, they really are then in desperate shape. So these are very serious issues and ones that I think the president and the administration takes very, very seriously, and it's one of the reasons I'm here.
Gottlieb says SCF has transformed the way health services are delivered. For instance, she says customers pick their own primary health care provider and have easy access to a range of services such as traditional health and massage therapy, as well as education and preventive care. The results, she says, are a 40% drop in visits for emergency and urgent care, 30% fewer hospital days, a 95% customer satisfaction rate, and improved health in some areas, all at about 63% of the cost of other health care providers. Sebelius asked if the SCF model would translate to other cultures. Gottlieb says yes, as long as care providers replicate the most important step, listening to their customers.
If you got the check today, with where you get services, what would you change? And that's what we asked. And our customer owners, our people said, we don't like this, we want this. We don't like this, but we like this. We want this, we would rather have this. And those things that they asked us for, we changed.
Senator Begich says he believes the nation would benefit from the SCF model and from Alaskan programs in prevention, recovery, employment, and Head Start, all of which are under the secretary's jurisdiction.
So we think we have some models that she might be able to take back, and as we deal with these tough budgets, maybe there's some ways to take some of our ideas and help save some money, at the same time deliver better care.
Gottlieb also told Sebelius the federal government has never fully met its obligations in exchange for the vast lands and resources tribes relinquished. Sebelius says the president and administration are working to change that. She also says deployment of U.S. Public Health Service's health professionals and National Service volunteers will become more strategic. Sebelius next travels to Fairbanks, Nenana, and Anaktuvuk Pass, a predominantly Nunamut Eskimo village of 324 people. It's located in the Brooks Range. In Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Dozens of Esther residents and many others gathered in the community west of Fairbanks recently as part of an effort to raise money to build a library there. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
One of those at the Throwdown and Music Fest, J.D. Reagan, says he just got back to Esther from a job up north so he could hear some of his favorite musicians, including a group appropriately named the Esther Jelly Jam, playing in one of his favorite venues.
Great music, great pies, right here on the porch of the Golden Eagle.
Another local, Deborah Reimer, says she's hopeful that the event will help Esther finally afford a library because it'll benefit the town in many ways.
There's, you know, then the kids' classes and there's just opportunities for community outreach. We're talking about doing community gardens there.
Reagan and Reimer are active members of a community filled with activists, along with artists and artisans and a few hundred other folks, many of whom have a way of going about things differently. That's at least part of the reason that Esther residents are trying to build the library their way. That, and what organizers of the effort believe would be an uphill struggle to get the Fairbanks North Star Borough to build a library in Esther. Deidre Helfrich, one of the leaders of the effort, says the fundraising drive, now in its seventh year, is probably a more realistic way for a small community to get a library these days because the borough's library budget is so tight.
They're always essentially strapped. I mean, look at the trouble they had to try to repair the roof.
Yeah,
and expand North Pole. Right now, certainly for at least the next 10 years, as far as I can see, they cannot afford to have a library out here on the West End.
Helfrich is the editor and publisher of the Esther Republic, a bi-monthly publication with community news and other features. She took a few minutes Saturday to sit down and explain the effort to bring a library to Esther. She says it began in 1999 when Frank Thorell, one of the community's colorful characters, happened across some boxes of discarded books.
He's a mad dumpster diver, and so he found a couple boxes of books sitting next to a dumpster and was like, can't throw these out.
Helfrich says Thorell brought the boxes back to his house, and soon word got around that he was accepting donations of books. Helfrich got involved soon thereafter, and before long, she and a few others started organizing the growing book collection and declared the room in which it was shelved as the Esther Library, soon renamed the John Trigg Esther Library after another local, whom Helfrich says was an avid reader and an excellent storyteller. The library's collection now exceeds 20,000 books in several locations, waiting for a place to put them. So Helfrich and others began organizing events in 2004 to raise money for the John Trigg Esther Library. Organizers bought land about 3 years ago, and they hope Saturday's event and another later this fall will help push them over the $820,000 they estimate they'll need to build a 3,200-square-foot building. Helfrich says it'll be an energy-efficient, eco-friendly structure that'll save money and serve as a model and teaching tool. In Esther, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, Do you know a nonprofit executive or tribal leader who is at risk for job burnout? Nominate them for a Rasmussen Foundation sabbatical, which provides paid time away for personal renewal and growth. Go to Rasmussen.org for more information, but don't wait. Nominees must complete an application by October 1st. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
The fall chum run on the Yukon River has surpassed expectations with a return in excess of average. State management biologist Jeff Estenson says the run is approaching 900,000 fish, better than the 700,000 average for this point in the season.
It's the biggest run we've seen probably since the mid-2000s, and it's certainly bigger than we've seen probably in the last 3 or 4 years. So more than adequate to meet our escapement goals throughout the drainage. Certainly have not needed to take any restrictions of the subsistence fisheries this year, and has definitely provided for one of the bigger commercial fisheries that we've seen in recent years.
Estenson says commercial fishermen mostly near the Yukon River's mouth have harvested 219,000 chum so far. He says the run is expected to taper off in the next week. The Yukon silver salmon return is coming in about average. About 144,000 cohos had come through the lower river as of Sunday, better than the 140,000 fish average for that date. The Southeast commercial salmon harvest is one for the record books this year, and it's not done yet. While the Seine Fleet's pink salmon catches in southern southeast have remained below expectations, the huge volume from the northern districts and high prices have made this season more valuable than ever. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein has an update.
The value of the Seine catch has surpassed a record $100 million, largely thanks to huge returns of fat pink salmon in northern southeast Alaska. Fish and Game's regional biologist Bill Davidson was confident that by season's end, the 2011 catch will easily exceed the preseason forecast of 55 million pinks.
The combination of the, you know, record return on the north end and good average weights and best ever prices have probably blown away any previous value record, and it's still going.
With some areas winding down and others showing some late returns, Davidson expected the fleet would continue fishing into early September. By late August, Saners had netted more than 53 million pink salmon, which is more than twice last year's catch. They also had brought in nearly 2.5 million chum, a half million sockeye, and 300,000 coho. Chum is typically the second most important species for Saners behind pinks, but chum catches have been lower than expected due to some poor hatchery returns. According to Davidson, it's typically the southern southeast districts below Petersburg and Wrangell that produce more than 60% of the pink harvest. This year, it's only 14%. However, the northern districts more than made up for the poor returns in the south.
In District 12, they've harvested 22 million pinks from that one district. The prior record was 16.4 million in 2005, so the record is blown away by the strength of this return. Likewise, District 13 is going to be a record harvest. It's now at 7 million, and the record for the district was 5.7 in 1985.
On average, pinks have been fetching a whopping 42 cents a pound for Saners. Prices have been strong nearly across the board, with the exception of coho, which have been exceptionally small in size and worth only about 50 cents a pound to Saners on average, though the prices are better for other fisheries. Seine sockeye has been going for $1.50, and chum has been worth 82 cents. With the big pink numbers and the high prices in general, Davidson was a little surprised that participation had not been drastically different than in recent years, with 268 Saners recording landings. The 10-year average is 259. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
Alaskans facing foreclosure on their home have another couple of weeks to apply for some help from the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
HUD has reopened the application process for the Emergency Homeowners Loan Program in 27 states, including Alaska. The eligibility criteria for the program is pretty strict, and that's one of the reasons why the application period has been reopened. Lee Jones is a HUD spokesman.
This is not an easy program for people at risk of foreclosure to qualify for. It's a fairly targeted group of people who either have experienced unemployment or underemployment or big medical bills.
The original deadline to apply to the Emergency Homeowners Loan Program was July 27th, but the new deadline is now September 15th. Homeowners at risk of foreclosure who qualify can get an interest-free loan that can pay a portion of their monthly mortgage for up to 2 years or up to $50,000. Jones says those who qualify must be those who, due to economic conditions or a medical condition, find themselves unemployed or underemployed after January the 1st of 2009.
That's the basic eligible criteria. There's also an income eligibility as well. What it would do is to provide them with up to a $50,000 bridge loan, which is a forgivable bridge loan. The bridge loan will be used essentially for two purposes. The first purpose would be these are folks who are already in default, and this would allow them to pay off using a portion of the bridge loan to pay off their mortgage arrearages, that is the 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 months that they're behind. It would allow them to wipe that slate clean by paying off the lender. Secondly, what it would do, assuming there were funds left over, was that it could lower their monthly mortgage payments for a period of up to 2 years to, again, allow them to get a bit back on their feet.
Jones confirms that in order to qualify, a homeowner must contact a participating counseling agency, and you can find the participating counseling agencies in Alaska on the Emergency Homeowners Loan Program website at findehlp.org.
When they get there, there's a directory of counseling agencies. There's a drop-down menu, and I believe there are one or two in Alaska that they need to contact. You can only make application through those counseling agencies.
If you don't have internet access, you can also call a toll-free hotline at 1-855-346-3345. The funds are handed out on a first-come, first-served basis, and there is no cost to apply. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
A subsidiary of the Regional Native Corporation for Northwest Alaska has opened a new hotel in Kotzebue. Nana Development Corporation opened the Nulugvik Hotel on Monday after 2 years of construction. The hotel has 78 guest rooms, including 7 suites. The company says the facility will provide modern high-tech meeting space for up to 100 people, an observation area, and a fitness center. The hotel includes a full-service restaurant overlooking Kotzebue Sound with a private dining room available for small meetings or celebrations. Nulugvik is an Inupiaq word meaning a place to rest. Nana Development is the business arm of Nana Regional Corporation. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Shane Iverson in Bethel, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, Tim Ellis in Esther, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, and Mike Mason in Dillingham. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Renewable Energy Alaska Project, celebrating 7 years of educating Alaskans on clean, local, sustainable, renewable energy. Find out more online at realaska.org. The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
You can find APRN headlines from around the state online at alaskapublic.org. There you'll discover local and worldwide news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.